We're on with Dr. Herbert Aptheker. Are you there, Herbert?
Yes, I am.
Good. I don't know how I introduce somebody like you, author of about 40 books, noted scholar, often kept from the university for decades and decades, close, very close to Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois and his literary executor. We have so much to talk about, I don't know where to begin. Could you just give us something of your quick on your background?
Well, I'm 82 years old. I was born in Brooklyn. I was formally educated at Columbia, where I got my doctor's degree. I was in the field artillery in World War II, and fought in France and Belgium and Holland and Germany, and was slightly injured, but nothing serious, and came home. I was appalled by the situation that I witnessed in the South when I was a youngster of 15 or 16 in the early 30s. I had been largely raised by a wonderful Afro-American woman, and she was like my mother. I loved her next only to my mother. This was Angelina Corbin. And when I went down there in the middle of the Depression, 1930-31, and saw the unbelievable conditions south of the Mason-Dixon line. Of course, I was a kid, but I had a column in the high school newspaper at Erasmus, and I devoted it to what I call the dark side of the South. And I don't know if people kept reading it, but I kept writing it. And from then on, more or less devoted my life to investigating, explaining, and combating this scourge of racism. I don't know how long you want me to talk about.
Well, I just wanted to, you know, make reference to what you did going down to Georgia in the middle 30s, essentially helping slaves escape.
Yes, I was down there under a pseudonym. We had established, through the initiative of a black fellow, a lawyer from Chicago, who had come from Oglethorpe County in Georgia, where peonage or actual slavery existed. It's a long story, but what finally happened, an abolished peonage committee was founded, W.C. Handy, and all sorts of famous people were on it. I was its secretary, and someone had to go down there, and he had to be white. So I went down there, and under a pseudonym. It had all been prearranged. The folks knew I was coming, and so on and so forth. Anyway, we were able to free in an underground railroad with friends. We got bus tickets, and no more than two people would go at one time. And they'd go south, not north. They'd go to New Orleans, where friends had a bookstore, and then they'd be met and sent up to Nashville, and from Nashville to Chicago, and be free. We kept this up. I stayed in different rooms every night and so on. And one night, while I was shaving, I was a kid. I used to shave about twice a week. A black man was mopping outside our little lavatory, and he said, "Go home." And I turned to him and I said, "What did you say?" He didn't look at me, but he said in a louder voice, "Go home now," which meant I'd been discovered. I'd used the name Beale down there. So that day, I took a bus and went to Atlanta and then went home. I don't know who that man was, but he saved my life. So we carried on a battle against peonage and won a couple of court cases. The thing that really broke peonage at that time was the invention of a mechanical cotton picker by the Russ brothers, I think around 1940. And also, of course, the war, where hundreds of thousands of black troops were required. So that's a little bit of a story of battle against peonage.
What about your early writings? You really started to... Go ahead.
Because of this deep interest, and I was a student of history at Columbia, and I got my master's in 37, and my doctor's a few years later, and my master's was on Nat Turner's Rebellion, which at that time was pretty much unknown. This was in Virginia in 1831, and it was one of the leading actual outbreaks of the slaves against their enslavement. So I studied that very intensively and went down to the Library of Congress and so on and so forth. Did a great deal of work. And in connection with that, I met and was encouraged by the great Carter G. Woodson, who's the father of black history, as you perhaps know. He met me once at the train station. We couldn't eat in a restaurant in those days. We could only eat in a sort of a stool place in the Union Station. But he invited me back, and I remember we went back. I went back, I don't know, a month or two later, and he met me. He was, of course, much older than I. I was a kid of 20. And he took me to the ghetto, to a restaurant. I remember it was down below street level. It was daylight, and I was a little startled. I showed that as we went down. He took my arm, and he said what I'll never forget. He said, "Herbert, you may eat with us. We are civilized." So he was a mentor. He's really the founder of what we call Negro history. He established the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History in 1915, and the Journal of Negro History, which is still published. He died in 1950.
Right. You also associated with Paul Robeson around this time.
Yes, I knew Paul, and once in a while we shared platforms. Once in Columbia, South Carolina, at a great mass meeting. I don't know who arranged this, but he had spoken and had sung with his magnificent presence and voice. And then here I come, I'm introduced to say something about black history, which was quite a moment for me. I don't remember what the hell I said, but...
Hard act to follow. I can sympathize.
I was in South Carolina. By the way, we had a jammed meeting. It was a Southern Negro Youth Congress, which organized that. We also called it SNCC. And Jim Jackson, who is living, and Louis Burnham, who isn't, were the main organizers.
Yes, Jim Jackson's still here in Brooklyn.
Yeah, no, he's in Brooklyn, yes. Jim was a heroic, and he's a marvelous person.
Yes, yes.
So, anyway, the sheriff came and looked at the thousands and thousands of people inside and outside and decided to hell with it. He was not going to enforce the Jim Crow regulation. I remember that vividly. So it was all part of the struggle, and I've been in it all my life. And then my master's thesis on Nat Turner was finally published in the 60s. Nobody would publish it in the 30s. But in the 60s, with all the commotion, it was published. It's in print. And meanwhile, I developed my study of slave rebellion in general.
Right.
And wrote about that beginning in the 30s. And then my doctor's dissertation, which was published by Columbia in 1943.
You know, I think we have to pause to let the listeners know what the significance was of discussing and letting the public know about slave rebellions.
Yes.
You want to respond to that?
Well, you're quite right. The dominant view, which was, of course, part of the racism, was that the Afro-American here was docile and passive and accepted his enslavement. In fact, loved it. This, of course, was part of the racist mythology. I knew in my bones that this could not be true. I knew black people. I knew Jim Jackson. I knew Lou Burnham. I knew my dear Angela Corbin. And I mean, this was just obviously part of a rationalization for Jim Crow and the terrible treatment of black people. So with this foreknowledge, I went into the field of studying and went to the sources, manuscripts, and so on. I had some difficulty, which might be interesting. I began to publish. I published The Negro in the Civil War, I think in 1938, and then a brief study of rebellion called Negro Slave Revolts in 39, and The Negro in the American Revolution, and The Negro in the Abolitionist Movement in the early 40s. So I was by then pretty well known. That's why the fellow came to see me about the peonage business when I went down there. There I was deeply engaged in this, and finally went to various archives. I remember when I went to Columbia, South Carolina, to the Memorial Building, where they had the main library and the documents that I needed. The woman, the librarian, white woman, of course, said that what I wanted they couldn't find. They couldn't find. Finally, through my thick skull, I realized they were not going to find it. Well, I was visiting then, a marvelous black woman, a historic figure, Modjeska Simpkins, who was a leader of the struggle back there. I told Modjeska of this problem. She picked up the phone and spoke to what was called the janitor. He was actually the archivist, and she told him about the needs of this young fellow. She vouched for me, and we set up an appointment, and he met me Sunday morning in front of the Memorial Building, opened it, and I had the archives before me. And this was basic to my American Negro Slave Revolts, because the documents were full of court records and so on and so forth. I could not, at the time I published the book, I could not pay tribute to this fellow. He probably would have been at least fired, maybe killed. I don't know what would happen to him. But that's part of the story, part of the struggle, part of what went on in those days. By the way, Modjeska is gone now. She died a few years ago, a heroic and historic black woman, a tremendous figure. Somebody ought to write a biography of Modjeska Simpkins of South Carolina.
Very, very good. I must admit, as a fellow researcher, I've been amazed at. I've always wanted to ask you this question, Herbert. How, in particularly doing your 8-volume or 7-volume documentary history.
Seven volumes.
Okay. How did you transcribe those documents? Did you have any kind of a device with you?
That's a very interesting question, because those books, volume one, was published in 1951, and I worked on it furiously when I came back from the war for a few years, but in those days, you had to write with a pen and a pencil, and some of the rare documents, for instance, the Library of Congress, you were not allowed to use a fountain pen in transcribing those documents. And there were no mechanical devices. It was just a typewriter. That's all we had. We went back home. So that first volume, which is published in two volumes now by Citadel, the first volume appeared in 51. It's about 900 pages.
I have an original set.
Yes.
Signed by you.
Yes. Well, there it is. And it finally was published in 51. It was the documents that are published are about half of those that I discovered. But the publisher pleaded with me, you know, and finally we agreed and made it one volume. And at that, it's almost 100,000 pages. So.
Yeah.
But I owe a great deal to that publisher. At that time, Philip Foner, the historian, was associated with Citadel Press, and Morris Sorkin was one of the partners. They're both gone.
Mm-hmm.
But Citadel stayed with me right on through the seven volumes. So, and in those days, to publish Apteker, I was pretty notorious with my radical activities. And to publish Apteker on what we called the Negro question, it was actually heroic, you know. It was heroic.
I think people, you're right, and I don't think people can understand that.
Yes,
to write on slave revolts was to arouse suspicion.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you were doing it the first.
That's right. That's right. It was really something. As I think back at it, I marvel at the fact that people were willing to help me and stand by me. And without that, of course, nothing could have been done. By the way, standing by, I've been married to Faye over 60 years. So when it comes to standing by, there she
That's
is.
That's a prize example, right.
And she, in fact, typed my 500-page dissertation, American Negro Slave Revolts, in five copies on a portable typewriter. This was a test of love, if there ever was one.
I'd like to start going toward the, you know, the vast field of your relationship with Dr. Du Bois and his work. When you were talking about the slave revolts, and we were saying how revolutionary a concept that was in American historiography, his Black Reconstruction was also a revolutionary
Absolutely.
Book. Was
that was published in 1935.
Yes.
You're quite right. Yes.
You want to speak about that and what that was about?
What do you mean, about Du Bois?
Yeah,
himself?
About Du Bois' Black Reconstruction and why that was...
Well, that was a smashing book, a revolutionary book. It was originally published by Harcourt Brace. The partner there, Alfred Harcourt, was a very enlightened person and a friend of Du Bois. And published it. It's a very big volume. I think it's about 700 pages. By the way, the American Historical Review never reviewed that book. Never. And when Du Bois died in 1963, the American Historical Review had two lines on the death of Du Bois.
What a commentary.
This gives you some idea of how awful conditions were in this connection. So Black Reconstruction was a pioneering work in history and in what we then call Negro history. And of course, I was a kid, but I went to it at once and read it and devoured it. And its whole approach, which was simply an approach that black people were human beings. That was the main thing in it. I mean, that was the revolutionary thing, that black people were human beings. And having been enslaved, they resented it and fought against it. And after the Civil War, they tried to achieve a full freedom and so on, like any other people would do. And Du Bois' book documented that in the post-Civil War period. It's a pioneering work, a very important work.
I just wanted to add also, it was revelation to people to read about the fact that black men with white men wrote constitutions in South Carolina,
right.
North Carolina, Louisiana,
right.
and so on.
That's right.
Ran legislatures, got into the governorship, and elected 22 men to Congress, 22 black people to Congress.
That's correct.
I mean, people didn't know it.
And did very well. When these things were mentioned in the past by people like U.B. Phillips and other racist historians, when they did mention them, they sneered at it, you see, and threw mud at it. But Du Bois showed that these people were extraordinary human beings who did very well. So the book was just a revelation. Now, you asked me about my relationship with him, right?
Right.
Yeah, well, of course, I think I wrote about the book at the time. I was beginning to edit, to be one of the editors of New Masses. And I certainly, then his first sort of autobiography came out called Dusk of Dawn. I think that was about 39. And I wrote about that at considerable length. I also was somewhat critical of it. Don't forget, I was about 26 years old, which means I knew everything, you see. So I was critical of Du Bois's Dusk of Dawn. But he wrote me a letter. He wrote me a letter in which he said my review was the best review he had received. Well, I was stupid, but not that stupid, not to follow that up. And with that, we began something of a relationship, continuing until I went into the war. And when I came back from the war, this marvelous miracle happened. First of all, after the war, I got a Guggenheim Fellowship, which was a miracle. But of course, it was a different time, you know. It was before the Cold War, and I came back as an officer. In fact, I had by that time reached I was a major by that time. And I was attacked in Congress by Eastland and Rankin and so on and so forth. And by the way, Woodson wrote me a beautiful letter at that time, welcoming me home and telling me that the pages of the Journal of Negro History were open to me and so on. This meant a great deal to me at the time of the attacks. At that time, before the real Cold War, the Army defended me. And I had recently been promoted. But about 2 or 3 years later, when the Cold War began, at the instance of the President, Mr. Truman, my commission was taken away from me. But that's a different story and a long story. So that was part of the Cold War in the 50s. But with Du Bois, he then invited me, believe this, to share his office. He was then the director of research at the NAACP. He had an office on 40th Street, across the street from the public library. And he said, "Herbert, would you like to share my office while you do your research?" Can you imagine that good fortune? And I did. And I was 12 feet away from Du Bois, as he did his work and I did my work in his office. He said to me, "Herbert, if you have a question, just ask. Don't worry about it." He had a fabulous memory. I would ask him about some Kentucky convention in 1890, and he'd say, "Oh, yes, he'd tell me all about it." So I had the Public Library of New York across the street, and at my elbow I had Du Bois, the epitome of black history. Can you imagine that? And so I worked furiously for about a year and a half until the NAA fired him because they became pro-Cold War, and he continued in his marvelous policies of human freedom. So they fired him. I think that was, 19... I don't remember when it was. But anyway, they fired him. And that ended that. But our relationship continued, and when I completed my documentary history, I think he suggested that he would do a preface. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, he did the preface to Volume 1 and was laudatory. He held it as a pioneering breakthrough work and so on. And that preface is published in Volume 1 of the documentary. Well, we remained, Fay and I, and the doctor, and then Shirley Graham, whom he married, we remained close friends. We used to visit his home in Brooklyn. My little one at that time, Bettina, who's now a very famous professor, we used to visit, Bettina and I would fall in on him on Sunday, and we knew that he liked it. He loved Bettina. And we'd come in, he'd be fully dressed. He was always formally dressed. He'd be half reclining on the couch reading the New York Times. And he'd see the two of us, he'd see the little one, and his face would lighten up. And he'd take her out, he'd play with her, or he'd sit on the piano and sing Old Man's, Old Man's something or other. And he loved her, and of course she worshipped him. So Fay and I became very, very close friends of Dr. Du Bois and Shirley. And they were at our home, we were at their home, we'd have dinner, and he educated me in more ways than one. Shall I tell you a story?
Sure.
We were having dinner, and Shirley brought in a cake that she had baked herself. And my portion was before me, and I devoured it in typical New York fashion, you know. I just devoured it. Du Bois stopped eating and looked at me and berated me, chided me, and said, "Herbert, what is the matter with you? What kind of manners do you have? Shirley worked on that cake so long, and there it is before you. You just ate it up like a dog," and so on. He really was mad at me. I don't know whether my habits improved, but I remember that. And it is indicative of the relationship. I mean, I, of course, loved him and thought of him as a father. And Shirley told Fay that he returned that. He thought of Herbert as his son. And by the way, he lost his son, you know, when young Du Bois was about 3 years old. They lived in the ghetto in Philadelphia, and the child died. Mrs. Du Bois never recovered from that, by the way.
This is William Lauren Katz, and we're back on with A Hands-On Approach to Multicultural America. And we'll be back to Dr. Apfaker, Dr. Herbert Apfaker, the noted scholar, in a moment.